We start today in Woburn, where more than 4,000 students are back in classrooms for the first time in a week. That's because teachers there have been on strike since last Monday after contract negotiations stalled. Woburn is one of a handful of districts recently that have taken to the picket lines to get deals signed. And here to talk more about the contract, what it means for Woburn teachers in this week from the newsroom, is WBUR education reporter Max Larkin. Hi, Max.
Hi, Yasmeen.
So negotiations were happening over the weekend between the school district, the city, the Woburn Teachers Associations. Get us up to the latest. How does this compare? How does the deal reach compare with what the union originally wanted?
Yeah, I think in this bargaining kind of impasse, more than others that I've seen, paraprofessionals were at the center of it, right? So these are support professionals who are in the classroom working closely, often with students with disabilities. One of them told me she's the teacher's right-hand man, and they tend not to get paid very much money.
Around $22,000.
That's exactly right. Yeah. And so you heard that as a refrain, pay our paras, support our paras. 40% raise in this contract. It has to feel over 4 years, but it has to feel like a victory, I think, for the union. That's a considerable step toward a living wage.
And the living wage in Woburn, I might add, is around $46,000. That is a significant discrepancy.
Yes, and they're not going to get there, but that's just the starting salary. So maybe as you move up the scale, at least this is a step in the right direction. A smaller raise, 13.5% for teachers. You know, you have to think that those educators were thinking about inflation and the 7%, 8% increase in prices that we've seen. So you really have to supersede that number to get a raise at all, as cost of living has gone up. And they've done that. And then one last sort of more niche request was physical education 2 days a week in the elementary schools. That made it into the contract or into the agreement, but as a recommendation for city leaders and not binding. So it's not a clean sweep of their priorities.
I see. And have you heard from both sides yet? The deal is still pretty fresh, but I'm wondering if they're both happy with it, both a little bit upset about it. Like, what are the tensions here?
I think it's a true compromise for reasons that we'll discuss. They both, it was an exhausting week. You had dozens of teachers, their supporters, massed in quite cold weather on Woburn Common day after day, parents kind of looking, scrambling for childcare arrangements. So you have the union saying, we think this is a fair contract, and the mayor saying this is a fair contract. The union thanked the community for their support. The mayor thanked them for their patience.
Well, let me ask you about one of the stipulations, and that's the return to work agreement. The union agreed to pay fines. There's $85,000 to the state, $225,000 to the city. Do you have any sense on how both sides came to that compromise? Like, is it common for teachers' unions to pay the fines associated with striking? Because you can't strike in Massachusetts legally as teachers.
Yeah, I think that's what makes it common. You know, these are strictly speaking illegal strikes. So we had a strike earlier in the fall in Malden. They got it done in a day and, as far as I know, didn't pay fines to the state. But given the fact that for 100 years these strikes have been illegal in the state, you can expect there to be some, you know, legal comeuppance consequences for going on them. I think the unions have gauged that to be a risk worth taking.
So, again, like, this is happening in districts across Massachusetts. And I want to get your sense of, has it been the same flashpoint over and over again in places like Haverhill and Brookline? We've seen them at the picket fence, you know, in the last year. So I really want to know, like, what has set them off.
Yeah, I'm hoping we can discuss that more. But I would say, in a word, it is the same flashpoint. It has been an incredibly difficult few years in the profession. The labor leaders would say that the discount you get by becoming a teacher with an advanced degree versus another job is growing. And I think there just feels like there's a respect deficit. That's something you hear about again and again on the picket lines, that it feels like, here we came in during the pandemic, did everything you asked us to do, and it didn't feel like the cities and towns were necessarily reflecting all that service, and particularly for these paraprofessionals who aren't just underpaid in Woburn but tend to be underpaid relative to a living wage throughout the state.
Max, thank you. Hang on tight. I do want to bring in a second voice, Max Page. He's the executive director of the Massachusetts Teachers Association. Max, are you there?
I am, Tiziana. Good to see you. I'm actually the president, the elected president of the Massachusetts Teachers Association.
All good. I'm Yasmeen. I'm filling in for Tiziana. Close second.
Well, I'm sorry about that.
You're all good. Thank you so much, Max, for being here. But I'd love to get your reactions to the compromise in Woburn. Are you happy with the deal? How do you feel about it?
I'm happy because the Woburn Teachers Association members are happy. They saw dramatic improvements in their contract for, especially for their paraprofessionals, some of the lowest paid, most revered, but most lowest paid in our public schools. They're going to see a huge increase in their pay. The educated teachers and nurses as well are going to be doing much better. And I think as beyond even the contract, I think the Woburn Teachers Association saw and gained enormous support from the parents, the students, the community. And so this will have a lasting impact, positive impact on both the educators and the public schools in Woburn.
I want to play some sound that our producer, Amanda Beeland, she spoke to Tom Scott, who is the head of the Massachusetts Association of School Superintendents. Take a listen to what he said.
There's a lot of sympathy here, because it's not just, the classroom teacher who's feeling this. You know, we're seeing higher numbers of principal and superintendent turnover. We're seeing people who are sort of questioning whether they want to stay in the profession. You know, we're dealing with something that we've never dealt with before and trying to work through it. And I think that part of the striking that's taking place is looking for a place of respect and understanding and appreciation. And some of that comes through the negotiations process.
So, Max Page, can you hone in on something he said? This is something we've never dealt with before. Is that something you're feeling too as an educator? Like, what is it like in the classroom for education and educators these days?
Well, I think, the pandemic was just a massive upheaval for our whole society and certainly for our public schools and for everyone involved, the students and the educators, the parents, the whole community. And I think what is going on is that we're still obviously somewhat in the pandemic and obviously dealing with the after effects. And our educators were traumatized by that, but therefore also saying they're going to demand more for their public schools. And so they are impatient with, for instance, with continuing to wait for years and years and years for improvements to the pay for paraprofessionals. They're more insistent on having the kind of prep time, the collaboration time, so they can do their best work in the classroom. They're seeking paid family medical leave, which every other worker in the Commonwealth has, but not municipal employees. So there are a number of ways in which the pandemic clarified things, like these are the things we need in our schools for health and safety and for the curriculum and for better education, and we're going to simply insist on it. And I think many of our members have said enough is enough. We're tired of waiting for some of the important improvements that we have been asking for many, many years.
So on that note, are you expecting to possibly see more strikes? And is the reason, part of the reason we are seeing more strikes, as Max Larkin mentioned, is that there's some sort of coordination, official or not, between districts?
There are districts, so the MTA is made up of 400 locals. They are independent organizations, and they make their decisions on their own. As I said, what we've seen, even in contract negotiations that do not result in strikes, there's more activism, more engagement, more demands that the districts respond. And I think there's a reason why we have filed a piece of legislation calling for the return of the right to strike on behalf of public school and educators. It would not cover fire and police and corrections. We actually think that if after 6 months of good faith bargaining, that's what the legislation does. You bargain for 6 months. If after that your educators would then have the legal right to strike, we actually believe there would be fewer strikes. And that's because at the moment, there is basically zero pressure on school districts to settle contracts. If they simply sit there, twiddle their thumbs, do nothing, we might be able to file something called an unfair labor practice for not bargaining well. And after 6 months of hearings, they'll get a slap on the wrist and told, oh, go back to bargaining. In other words, that's why we've had cases go on, for instance, in Brookline for several years. In Woburn, they negotiated this took over a year. It shouldn't take that long. And I think listeners need to understand that the bargaining system is totally weighted on the side of the employer. Some of our locals on their own have said, you know what, enough is enough.
So it would be a really big deal for us to change the law here in Massachusetts. The fact that teacher strikes are currently not legal. You are trying to change that. I understand Governor Maura Healey is not a fan of legalizing that. Are you optimistic that you will get that through? Talk to me about it.
So, you know, obviously we disagreed with what the governor said on a TV show. On the other hand, she also made crystal clear that she doesn't think that $22,000 a year for a paraprofessional, as was the rate in Woburn, is enough to live on. So she sees the problems and she sees the good things that our members are fighting for on behalf of their members and their students. So I think there's an education piece to go on there. And I think as we go about educating the legislature and the broader public on the inequity and the problems associated with the current law, I think we'll see some real movement. And I think many legislators have been really impressed with the idea of, yeah, you should be able to finish a contract in 6 months. If both sides come to the table, then you could do that. You did not have that in Woburn.
Max Page, Executive Director of the Massachusetts Teachers Association, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Max Larkin, can I go back to you real quick, our senior education reporter, for your reaction to what you just heard from the head of the Mass Teachers Association?
Yeah, I think my fellow Max spoke well. It's not just teaching, of course. You know, there are a lot of us throughout the economy who feel exhausted, a strange sense of dislocation, maybe working from home or working in a way that we're not used to. And then seeing that turn into a form of engagement, I don't think is the most surprising thing. So people paying attention to what's in that contract, whereas in the past, they might have just let it happen behind the curtain. And then I think he makes a good point in that this process is not optimized to produce quick outcomes. Now, whether that requires the return of the strike, I don't know. But you think of what happened in Woburn. Fines started to accrue as the strike began. Things dragged on. Mm-hmm. The teachers are feeling a pressure from both sides. It isn't exactly designed to produce an amicable result. Yeah. So the question is whether we can do better and make sure that our teachers are in the classroom by, in some ways, leveling the playing field.
Max Larkin, WBUR education reporter, thank you so much for being here. A group of children were sitting in front of drag queen Monica Moore when a group of men entered the room.
There was three at the time in ski masks. And they were stating things like, we just want to hear the man in the dress has to say. We just want to hear the story from, the man in the dress.
That's Amelia Horde. She and her children were at the Saturday morning drag queen story hour at the Taunton Public Library. She tells Rhode Island's WPRI station they were all having a good time until the masked men came into the reading room.
My children were shaking and crying, and they were terrified.
Even after the event was over, Horde said it had lasting effects.
My four-year-old, she's been having nightmares. She doesn't get it. She thinks these are bad guys, these are in masks. I was listening to a story that a princess was reading me, and then bad guys in masks came in.
All this sound is courtesy of WPRI and Providence, Rhode Island. Those protesters were part of a group called the Nationalist Social Club, also known as NSC 131. The Southern Poverty Law Center classifies them as neo-Nazis. It's the same group that disrupted two drag queen story hours in Boston's Seaport and JP neighborhoods last summer. And other story hours across the state, Back then, their protests were on the sidelines. But as seen in Taunton, they're getting more intense and disrupting events just feet away from performers and families. So with me now to talk more about how all of this is impacting their communities is Andrew Pollack, president of the South Coast LGBTQ Plus Network. Andy, welcome.
Good morning, Yasmin.
I also have on the line with me Hope Watt Bucci, president of the organization North Shore Pride. Welcome to you as well.
Thank you so much. Great to be on.
Great to have both of you. Let's start with Andy, because you were listening to that story just now from the parent. Your organization, the South Coast LGBTQ Plus Network, organized that story hour in Taunton. I am wondering what comes in mind for you when you hear a parent talk that way about that day?
Well, to finish the story, we provided due diligence. So we provided therapy for these families and children. So they're in counseling if they need to be, and we've keeping connection with the families so that they have some consistency and they have a support system to reach out to if they need it. What really was in my mind was how steady, composed, and well prepared our staff was, because they were in the room as well. And we are committed to peace and nonviolence, to de-escalation. But the women that were there were amazingly gifted at de-escalating, not engaging, and making sure that the children were safe. So I was really grateful. But it's scary. It really is scary.
Yeah, and as I understand it, this was the fourth time that happened in 3 months that the story hours were disrupted by neo-Nazi groups. I mean, is that number correct? And I want to hear about those times as well.
Well, there were they went from Taunton to Fall River, so that's two. And then there was two times in Fall River before this, but they weren't able to get inside. So it's just a little escalation from protesting, as you said, on the side of the street, to going inside the building, to standing next to children, being inappropriate. And, you know, the Taunton police, we're working with them. We're working with the Attorney General's office. We're working with various and sundry organizations so that we are guaranteed safety in our future events, which is a very big concern. We have Pride in Taunton and New Bedford and Fall River, about 1,500 people. They're really fun, well attended, well supported. But it does bring a little concern if we're having this type of protests.
Yeah. And Hope, I want to bring you in because a drag queen story hour that your organization, North Shore Pride, hosted also was disrupted by a neo-Nazi group. Just listening to what had happened in Taunton, is this familiar to you in terms of what happened in Boxford?
Yes, and I have to say that story hour was initiated by the Boxford Public Library, and North Shore Pride was there to support that event. And it was an amazing event until the protesters arrived. So North Shore Pride's position during that event was to be outside to support the story hour and to try and really keep an eye on the protesters who were across the street. And during that time, the story hour started. Thank you so much to the church. We actually couldn't hold it at the Boxford Public Library because of the town regulations, apparently. And so a church stepped up and opted to hold that event. And so then the protesters started yelling, calling us pedophiles, and a whole bunch of other things that I can't say on radio. But and then eventually several of the protesters came over. We stood in front of the church, in front of the door. The protesters burst through us, and then the library personnel, the Boxford Library personnel who were there, stood then behind us, and they just physically pushed their way right into that event, right into the story hour. Mm. It was terrible. Some people were hurt. Then the police arrived. And de-escalated the situation, took several of the people away.
Can I ask you, Holly, Because just in hearing you retell that story, I mean, it seemed like the tension is palpable. And I mean, maybe I could use a stronger word, but I think the thing that I'm trying to get to really understand of the LGBTQ plus community has always dealt with some level of harassment as a minority community. But I really want to get the sense from you, like, does this time around, like, does this period in time feel different to you?
Yeah, I started North Shore Pride in 2012. And other than the 2 years during COVID, active COVID, we've always been out doing events. And it's just seems to be escalating. And I think I told Amanda when I talked to her initially about this radio show that, in my opinion, it's come down to the fact that I think people have been given permission to hate publicly. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what we're seeing. And whether that be, precipitated by politics and what's going on in the country or what has gone on in the country in the last several years, I'm not sure. But socially, we seem to be a very targeted group again, remembering that we just celebrated, not too long ago, the 50-year anniversary of Stonewall riots. And now seemingly it seems to be, as it was then, we are seeing a resurgence, especially a resurgence of violence and discrimination against the transgender community.
Mm. We are, just to remind listeners, we are talking about the rise in anti-LGBTQ plus protests outside of Boston. And here with me is Hope Wadbuchi. She's the president of the organization North Shore Pride. And I also have with me Andy Pollack, president of the South Coast LGBTQ plus network. And just in case people are not familiar with what a drag queen story hour is, there's performer Monica Moore reading a story at one of those story hours at the Taunton Public Library in the spring of 2022.
Pop. Oh no. Another button popped off and rolled away. How many buttons are left? So another button fell off. Does anyone know how much is left on the coat? Two. 3 - 1 = 2. Did Pete cry? Goodness no. Buttons come and buttons go.
So that sound is courtesy of the LGBTQ voice on YouTube. And, innocent, just as the name says, drag performer reading a book for a group of children. Second piece of sound is drag performer Patty Bure, because host Tiziana Deering spoke with her last summer after her story hour was disrupted by neo-Nazis in Jamaica Plain.
One of the things that I hear a lot from people who oppose drag queen story hours is that I am desperate to get in the room with kids. And I just want to say that I have never once requested to do a drag queen story hour event. I'm a drag performer full time, so Drag Queen Story Hour is a great way to supplement my income, and I get many, many requests to do this.
So I play both of these tapes to ask, Hope, you had thoughts about this, about why you think Drag Queen Story Hours have become the target of these protests in recent months. But Andy, can I bring you back in and ask, what is it about these events that you think have become such a flashpoint in our culture?
I think it's safe. I mean, when they were going after hard targets like government buildings and state governors, they go to jail, correct?
Mm.
So it seems like they've moved to a topic that is controversial culturally, but safe as far as how many of these folks are going to jail disrupting story hours? That's a question I like to ask. And not many, if any. So I think it's just a change of tactic on their part. For us, it's disturbing. Everyone in that room was Corey checked. It's as to cross the T's and dot the I's of the law, we follow it, right to the letter. So everything was running incredibly smoothly that way. So,
yeah. Well, let me ask you the same question I asked Hope earlier. And I want to precede it with a little bit of statistics. According to data from the state, there were 406 reported hate crime incidents in Massachusetts, 19% of those being anti-gay. And that's the second highest category behind anti-Black incidents. So we know that it's not far from new, but Andy, do these feel different to you than past protests or demonstrations?
Yeah, you know, I was involved with marriage equality from 2003 to 2007 down in the South Coast. I was co-chair of the Marriage Equality Coalition. And we always would joke that it wasn't a good event if we didn't have protesters, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we'd always have folks on the side saying that they were against our marriage and what have you. But I've noticed a real difference. I've noticed that there they were just frustrated, you know, got kind of anti-gay, but they're there because their church told them to be there or whatever. But it just was a different feeling. And these guys that are breaking in are more like thugs. I mean, this isn't your mom and pa that went to a prayer meeting and got talked to go on a bus to some protest. You know, this is really thought out, organized, ski masks, backpacks, barging in, physicality, rough stuff that we haven't seen before. And that's what's scary.
Mm,
and you know what I'm saying? That escalation.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds scary just talking to you about it. But I have just a little over a minute left, so not much time to ask a pretty big question, Hope. And that is not doing these story hours an option? Is it even an option for you? And have you honestly thought about that?
No, it's not an option to stop. You know, the story hours are designed to promote diversity and equity and to, if you will, destigmatize, you know, the LGBTQ community. And it's intentional that, you know, we do story hours with children because that's the time that children learn, you know, about diversity. And so, no, it's very important because that's how you stop hate. You provide education to people and you do it at a young age and you take away the mystery and instead you add the intellect and you add the familiar.
And being present is just extremely important for you. And I get that. Hope Watt-Bucci, president of the organization North Shore Pride, thank you so much. And also with us, Andy Pollack, president of the South Coast LGBTQ Plus Network.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yasmeen, appreciate it. Thank you, Andy.
Take care.
New Hampshire is facing the loss of its first-in-the-nation Democratic primary. The Democratic National Committee voted over the weekend to move to South Carolina at the top of the primary calendar. Advocates for the change say South Carolina better reflects the racial diversity of the party's overall electorate. So joining us now is WBUR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks. Anthony, thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, Yasmeen. Nice to be here.
So I want you to remind us a little bit about what led up to this moment. How did we get here and how was this decision made?
Yeah, well, I mean, as you suggested there, New Hampshire's had this long tradition of going first, along with Iowa, which held the first caucuses before New Hampshire's primary. But many Democrats have argued for a long time that it's unfair to give such outsized influence to small, overwhelmingly white states like Iowa and New Hampshire. So over the weekend, the full DNC approved a proposal by the Rules and Bylaws Committee that will make South Carolina go first on February 3rd. 3 days later, New Hampshire and Nevada will go, followed by Georgia and Michigan. So this moves more diverse states up into those early voting contests. And as DNC party chairman Jamie Harrison says, the Democratic Party looks like America, and so does this proposal. But obviously, this does not sit well with a lot of folks in New Hampshire.
So can you talk more about that? Because I think my burning question is, do voters in New Hampshire care and do Democratic voters care in general across the country?
Yeah, I mean, it's a fair question. Yasmeen, you know, I'd say based on the many, and I've lost count of how many New Hampshire primaries I've covered, I would say voters care. I mean, whether they're going to be marching in the street over this, probably not. But I mean, I think they care in the sense that when you go to those town meetings, you know, week after week in the months leading up to the primary, lots of people turn out and attend. New Hampshire voters take this very, very seriously. In terms of the reaction from New Hampshire politicians, politicians, they say, look, we've got a state law that requires us to go first. And so we're going to go first, no matter what the DNC says. And that's true of Democratic leaders like Senator Jeanne Shaheen and Maggie Hassan, for example. And it's true of the Republican governor, Chris Sununu. They say, we've got a law to go first, and we're going to go first. And so that's the way it's going to be. The DNC responds by saying if New Hampshire insists on going first and not respecting their schedule, then the primary won't have any force. It'll just be a sort of state-sanctioned poll as opposed to a key piece of the nominating process.
So it's like saying you're going to do it, but we're going to kind of ignore it.
Yeah, that's kind of the idea.
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, no, go ahead, Yasmin.
You just mentioned the state law in New Hampshire, and I am wondering, that's one of the hurdles to implement this new policy. Are there others?
Well, I mean, the other hurdle is that the New Hampshire primary is still going to matter, especially in the coming year, in 2024, because the Republican primary is going to keep New Hampshire first. And that's where the action is going to be. We think that President Biden is going to run again. It's doubtful that he's going to have a significant challenger in 2024. So on the Democratic side, the primary is less important. The action is going to be focused on, you know, who is going to challenge President Biden from the Republican side. And so that's going to play out in New Hampshire as it always has. The interesting thing to watch will be, you know, the years that follow, if New Hampshire can somehow claw its special status back from the DNC. And that remains to be seen.
Mm. Anthony Brooks is WBUR senior political reporter. Anthony, thank you so much.
Oh, my pleasure, Yasmin.
What you're hearing right now is the beginning of Aaron Copland's Appalachian Spring, performed here by the Boston Symphony Orchestra and the London Symphony Orchestra. The piece first premiered with an accompanying ballet performance in 1944 and was considered a tremendous success. The late music and drama critic Terry Teachout, for example, said, "Probably the greatest piece of classical music composed by an American. Certainly the greatest dance score composed by an American, completely comparable in quality to the great ballets of Tchaikovsky or Stravinsky." All that is best about mid-century American music in this piece. But what is it that truly makes it great? Musician, author, and composer Rob Capello has made a career out of answering that question, and he was in town this weekend to highlight some of Aaron Copland's best work. He caught up with Radio Boston host Tiziana Deering before the concert, and the two talked about Appalachian Spring, starting with when Rob first discovered it as a 12-year-old child.
Yeah, it's true. You know, it's sort of an embarrassing personal story. But when I was 12 years old, Appalachian Spring was like one of my favorite pieces of music. Though I played several instruments as a teenager, I didn't really know anything about classical music, or certainly anything about Aaron Copland, but I absolutely loved Appalachian Spring. There was this old recording, which is the one you were just hearing. There was this old recording with Copland conducting the London Symphony Orchestra, and I used to listen to it almost every day. And on these particularly beautiful days, the sun would stream through my window, and I would imagine this wonderful Appalachian composer, Aaron Copland, sitting in a rocking chair on the front porch of his log cabin, gazing out at the Appalachian countryside in front of him and filtering the beauties of nature into his piece, Appalachian Spring. However, when I was 16, I was horrified to find out that not only was Copland not from Appalachia, he was in fact a Jew from Brooklyn. And in fact, not only that, but Appalachian Spring wasn't even the name of the piece when Copland wrote it. It was named the day before the premiere by the choreographer, Martha Graham, and Copland had no idea it was even about Appalachian Spring when he was writing it.
Okay, but I gotta stop you for, wait, just a second. So also Martha Graham? So Copland makes this piece and Martha Graham choreographed it?
Yeah, in fact, it was written for Martha Graham. And in fact, the title that Copland thought he was writing was Ballet for Martha. Huh. That was it. He had no idea. It was completely a commission from Martha Graham. And she was the one who actually gave it the name Appalachian Spring. But even when it was named Appalachian Spring, it still had nothing to do with Appalachia or spring, that was simply a line from a poem by Hart Crane that Martha Graham liked and thought it might make a good title. So it still had Appalachian spring having nothing to do with Appalachia or spring, and Copeland knowing nothing about it. But the thing that's so wonderful about it is Copeland says, I wasn't the only one who got this wrong. There's a great quote from him. He says, quote, I have been amused that people so often have come up to me to say, when I listen to that ballet of yours, I can just feel spring and see the Appalachians. But when I wrote the music, I had no idea what Martha was going to call it. Even after people learn that I didn't know the ballet title when I wrote the music, they still tell me they see the Appalachians and feel spring.
That's
well, I'm willing if they are.
That's so funny. So I first encountered it. I marched in the marching band at the University of Michigan, and we did a medley from it for a halftime show. And of course, being in the Midwest, I fully embraced the idea of sweeping farmlands and mountain landscapes. And, you know,
absolutely.
So it is stunning that that's not the case. And yet it is great, right? I mean, this spoke to me immediately. So Rob, we're going to dive into some of the music now. And one of the things that was interesting to me is you wanted to make sure that as we were doing that, we were looking at a particular form of performance of the music, which was with a pretty small ensemble, because apparently how many instruments there were kind of matters in this case.
Yeah, it was originally only written for 13 players because that's all they could fit in the room. But immediately the next year, once the piece was so popular, an orchestral version, a suite was created, removing about 10 minutes of the music, and it was for full orchestra. And for years, that's the only version anyone knew, because that's all anyone played. It wasn't until 1972 that the original version, the 13 instruments, was created to match the suite, the shorter version. So it wasn't until 1972 that anyone could hear the version that we're going to perform, which is the original 13-instrument version reduced by 10 minutes into a suite.
Almost
that's
30
a lot
years
of information
later.
There.
That's a lot. Yeah,
yeah, but it's much, much later, and no one knows that version. The only version anyone knows is the one that I heard when I was 12, which is beautiful for the full orchestra, but we're going to be doing the original 13-instrument version.
So take us into the beginning there.
Yeah, you know, in interviews, Copeland often talked about a French word, a trouvaille, a find, something that you stumble on, a kind of a compositional gift for the gods, which can become the basis of an entire piece. And Appalachian Spring is based on two of these finds, a chord, which I'm going to call the Appalachian Spring chord, and a shaker tune, 'Tis the Gift to Be Simple. Now, the Appalachian Spring chord, he discovered one day, he was just improvising at the piano, and his fingers happened upon this chord. And he kept playing this over and over again. You know, if you go to enough concerts, I'm sure you've read program notes that say things like, the entire piece grows out of this opening six-note idea. And, you know, I mean, it all seems like all you need to do is write a great opening idea and then you're done. Everything effortlessly flows from that. I mean, it really sounds, I wish that were so true. But, you know, in the case of Appalachian Spring, though it wasn't effortless, it certainly is true. That chord actually is the basis of the entire piece. And I'll just get you started and show you how it works. Now, the Appalachian Spring chords actually made of the two most basic chords in all of tonal music. The simplest progression in all of tonal music, the most basic cadence, is this. Now, these two chords, what musicians call tonic and dominant, or one and five, or home and away, these are the poles of the tonal universe. They are the most fundamental key-defining chords.
They sound like church, like everything I'd hear in church.
Exactly. That's it. You've heard it a million times. But if I play the right hand alone, and just take the second chord and play it an octave higher, so instead of this, I do this, and play them at the same time.
Now it sounds like Sun on the Water.
That's it. That is the Appalachian Spring chord. Now I can play all six notes at once. I can play them one at a time, what we call an arpeggio. So it's made of two three-note groups, what I'm going to call shaker one and shaker two. Now I just made that up. Shaker one and shaker two. But what makes the beginning so beautiful is the way it seems to grow from nothing. You know, oftentimes Copeland talked about Martha Graham's art as being seemingly, but only seemingly simple. And that's the key to Appalachian Spring. It is seemingly, but only seemingly, simple. So it starts off with the simplest thing you can possibly do. Three A's. The note the orchestra tunes to. Three A's. Then the clarinet will take that same A an octave higher, opening up that space. So we've got this A. Then we open up this space. Then we add the first two remaining notes of shaker one. The cello then takes that A down low, opening up that space.
Right, like so you can feel it, like you want it to sit there.
We are it's like a camera had started by focusing on a single point and then gradually pulled backwards to reveal the entire cadence. Then when we've got the low A, the chord unfolds for the first time. Shaker one, shaker two. Now, what's so beautiful about this opening is it's so simple, but also so courageous. For 3.5 minutes, Copland doesn't use a single accidental, a single note outside the key. It's like all you did, it's the equivalent of using only the white keys on the piano without a single black key, like having a crayon box with only primary colors. It's this bare, stripped-down, pioneer universe. So how do you get 3 minutes out of this one chord? Well, I'll get you started, and you'll have to hear the rest of it at the concert itself. All right, so the first time you hear it one note at a time. One, two, three, four, five, six. Well, the next thing he discovers is, what if I overlap those two groups and play the second one starting on the last note of the first one? So you get one exquisite moment of overlap. Instead of this, now you get this. One, two, overlap.
So shaker one bumps into shaker two.
Exactly. Shaker one bumps into shaker two. And then the flute and the clarinet simply takes notes out of the Appalachian Spring chord and create little melodies above it. While the piano opens up the lower space, that fantastic note, that is the lowest note on the piano. So we've had this A. We've had this A. We've had this A. Now we open up this A. Shaker one overlaps shaker two. Clarinet and flute play melodies above.
You know, every note you play makes me feel so calm.
Yeah, it is so serene because it has the courage of sticking with this incredible simplicity. Not a single accidental, one chord. What do you do from here? Well, what do you do? You take that chord and you transpose it. For non-musicians, that simply means taking the idea but starting it on another note. So if we call this, and again, these are my terms I made up, shaker home, then we can transpose it and do shaker away.
Oh,
so
my
now
way.
We've got two different versions. Now, for 10 measures, this is why you're so calm and serene. The accompaniment does nothing but alternate and rock gently back and forth between shaker home
like
and shaker away
in,
different combinations. Here is just the accompaniment. Shaker away, each note separate, overlap them, shaker away, overlap, shaker home, shaker away, shaker home.
I knew there was a reason I loved this music.
Just sitting and rocking back and forth between these two beautiful chords. Now, here's also what makes it so special. On top of this, we get a beautiful new melody in a distinctive new signature Copland orchestration. Normally, when a flute and a violin play a melody together, the standard way to orchestrate that is to have the flute play the same notes as the violin, but an octave higher. So if the melody is here in the violin, the normal thing to do is have the flute up here doing it an octave higher. However, Copland does the exact opposite. He puts the violin an octave above the flute, which makes this simple melody sound unbelievably poignant, yet not sentimental. All right, now you're ready to hear that whole opening segment, beginning from nothing, from three notes, opening up this A, opening up this A, the opening shaker home chord by itself, the overlap version, the transpositions. Here's a whole opening of like a minute and a half of music using nothing but this one Appalachian spring chord. The three A's. Clarinet above. Cello. Shaker one. Shaker two. Low piano, lowest A. Overlap. Melody in clarinet and flute. Transpose. Shaker away. Flute and violin. Violin an octave higher than the flute. Nowhere to go. Isn't that an incredibly beautiful opening?
And I feel like I'm meditating, right? I feel like,
yeah.
I, you know, and again, I don't know if it's my Midwest roots or your power of suggestion from earlier, but I feel like I'm sitting on a rocker on a big porch and just staring out at a gorgeous landscape.
And what's amazing is the courage to write that kind of music. Now remember, this is 1944. This won the Pulitzer Prize in 1945, and one of its principal competitors was Arnold Schoenberg's Ode to Napoleon. Classical music was writing some of the most dissonant, complex, atonal music that anyone else was writing. And the courage to write this kind of music, two tonal chords, back and forth, while the most complicated music was being written everywhere else. Truly an extraordinary moment.
That was Rob Capello, musician, author, and composer, talking with Tiziana Deering about what makes Aaron Copland's Appalachian Spring great.